Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
All right, then. This is Publius, and what can I say for myself? I am back in Texas, and I am currently in the midst of some extremely heavy-duty computer maintenance, which is very time-consuming. I'm migrating hard drives. Anyway, once I have finished with that, I will be able to go back to doing edits for, you know, audio editing for proper shows. I'll have my computer and everything else. I'll also be able to do several other things. So I now have some LPs, for example, one which is a production narrating the first achievement of the nuclear fission chain reaction back in December of 1942. I have the LP set partly narrated by Glenn Seaborg, partly by Chet Huntley, with voices of a number of important people. Century of the Atom, which was given away by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission at the 1971 Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. I also have an LP set which was produced for radio stations. It's a series of talks from AEC people, scientists, and officials. Let's talk about energy. Some of those, I think, will wind up as fillers because they're like 10 minutes long, and so if I've got 10 minutes left at the end of an hour, I'll just stick them in. That could be pretty nifty. But, yeah. Anyway, so that's one thing. Another thing is I now have received a number of additional films. So I think I told you that while I was in Europe, I purchased a number of films from France. I got four films. Two of them are newsreels, which have parts that are about nuclear energy, and two of them are public information films. And then also, yesterday, at my mail, I had a parcel containing three Soviet-made Russian-language educational films. One is about nuclear energy, and the other two are about electricity generally, but seem to have some nuclear energy content in them. Those, of course, I bought them from a guy in Ivano-Frankivsk, Ukraine. I don't know how he's doing, but this is the world we live in now, isn't it? We'd hoped we'd gotten away from that. Well, I'll have more to say about that on Saturday, undoubtedly. But, of course, I have still a number of films that have not yet been transferred. I've got quite a few films. And this just adds to the number of them. And, of course, they cost quite a bit, $10, $15 a minute to get transferred. So, obviously, anybody who wants to send me some money to help with that, that would be very welcome. But up to now, the bigger problem was that I had filled up my available hard drive space. I now have considerably more hard drive space available, or I will, as soon as this stuff finishes. Anyway, so I'm going to return with me now to those heady days of yesteryear. I'm going to return now to what I was reading last time. Nuclear Energy, a Prelude to H.G. Wells' Dream, from Continuing the Nuclear Dialogue by Alvin Weinberg. And honestly, since I only got, thinking about just starting from the beginning, not sure, but the dogs are barking, which is very annoying. But yeah, nuclear energy. Okay, when I left off last time, Dr. Weinberg was describing the Geneva conferences on the peaceful uses of atomic energy. He says, the other two Geneva conferences in 1958 and 1964 were more elaborate and larger than the first, but by this time, scientific exchange on nuclear matters had become somewhat old hat, and the political suspense that marked the earlier conference could hardly be sustained. The 1958 conference focused very heavily on progress in controlled thermonuclear fusion, and the United States put on an extraordinary display of operating fusion experiments that cost several millions of dollars. But now the nuclear business has just become too big for a single all-encompassing conference. By 1971, all have agreed that the Fourth Geneva Conference on Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy should be centered only around applications of nuclear energy, with almost no attention being devoted to basic nuclear science. Cooperation between East and West on non-military nuclear matters has flourished since the Geneva meeting in 1955 in three scientific areas: high-energy physics, controlled fusion, and power reactors. This cooperation has been particularly notable. In the first two fields, a true international community of experts has developed. People who know each other by their first names, who correspond freely, who share technical advances and setbacks openly and immediately. The exchange in power reactors, though also extensive, is rather less open, partly because some of the technology is close to the manufacture of nuclear bombs, partly because the business is beset by commercial rivalry. High-energy physics is one of the most expensive parts of modern science. To probe its boundaries requires huge accelerators. The 200 billion electron volt accelerator now being built at Batavia, Illinois, will cost $240 million. The world's largest operating proton synchrotron, capable of achieving 70 BeV, is the one at Serpukhov, not far from Moscow. Here is a scientific field where cooperation is clearly advantageous to all. Cooperation is typically regional, as exemplified by the very successful All-European Center for High Energy Research at CERN and its Soviet bloc counterpart at Dubna. But there is much exchange between the centers, with people from Dubna working at CERN or at Berkeley, and Americans and Europeans working on the big machine at Serpukhov. The high-energy community even has the equivalent of its Geneva conference, the Rochester Conference on High-Energy Physics, so called after its origin at the University of Rochester. The conference now is held every other year, alternating between the United States, Europe, and the Soviet Union, but always reinforcing the sense of identity felt by all workers in this difficult and expensive field. The jackpot question in high-energy physics now is, what shall come after the 200 BeV Batavia accelerator, or the actively discussed 300 BeV European accelerator? What about a 1,000 BeV or even larger machine? Such a device would cost perhaps $1 billion. Could it be an international accelerator, jointly supported by the United States, the Soviet Union, and Western Europe? And, as was suggested at a Pugwash meeting in 1962, could an intercontinental accelerator be located in Berlin and thus give that city a raison d'etre as an international center of science? Sporadic conversations between East and West about cooperation on a 1000 BEV machine have been held, but to date little has happened. International cooperation in controlled fusion has followed a parallel course. Here, the field is so difficult, and success has been so far from being achieved, that there is no question of commercial or military rivalry. Cooperation between East and West has been essentially complete. Many teams from the United States and other Western countries have visited the Soviet Union, and vice versa. During 1969, a British team from the fusion laboratory in Kulm conducted full-scale tests on the Russian tokamak. This is an experimental fusion device that has come closer to achieving the extreme conditions necessary for a controlled fusion reaction than has any other device. The Russians' claims for tokamak at first seemed to be so optimistic as to elicit skepticism from the rest of the fusion community, but the British team, using elaborate laser techniques not available in the Soviet Union, confirmed the Russian findings. Tokamak is now considered the nearest thing to a major breakthrough in this difficult search for a way to burn the waters of the sea and thus give mankind an infinite source of energy. International cooperation in reactor development has been rather less open, not only between East and West, but also among the various partners in the West. Nevertheless, numerous cooperative agreements have been in force for many years. Within the Western Bloc, the United States has bilateral agreements, which involve exchange of information and nuclear material. The most far-reaching is the technical exchange agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom, which goes back to the wartime cooperation. Under the terms of this agreement, the United States and the United Kingdom cooperate, largely by visits or exchanges of scientists, in several fields related to nuclear reactors and controlled fusion. On a different plane are the sister laboratory arrangements between the United States and several less developed countries, whereby the nuclear center in the less developed country is taken under the wing of a much larger U.S. national laboratory. Taiwan and Mexico are the responsibility of Argonne, Pakistan of Oak Ridge, and so on. The national nuclear laboratories in less developed countries usually are the largest and most powerful scientific institutions in those countries, yet they are addressed to problems that in the short run may not be crucial to the country's development. True, every country must sense a need. True, every country must sense a need to become sufficiently knowledgeable in nuclear matters to be able to follow the debate on nuclear proliferation, or even to have available some competence to handle an ultimate nuclear catastrophe. But these needs can hardly command the continuing interest of good scientists, and the elaborate installations set up in the less developed countries can hold their scientists only if the scientists can do something worthwhile. In imparting this sense of participation among scientists in the small countries, the sister laboratory arrangements are quite useful. Maybe I should have used rsync for that copy operation, then I would have actually at least had a progress indication. Perhaps the most intense international cooperation in peaceful nuclear matters has developed among the countries of Western Europe. Euratom, the nuclear arm of the common market, was established 13 years ago. The European Nuclear Energy Agency, the nuclear arm of the OECD, has been in existence for a comparable time, and there have been several very successful bilateral and multilateral nuclear projects in Europe. For example, the CERN High Energy Laboratory, the Franco-German research reactor now being built at Grenoble, the OECD Dragon project, a very successful high-temperature gas-cooled reactor built in Winfrith, England, the radiochemical processing plant at Mol, Belgium, built and operated under the same auspices, joint development of methods of waste disposal, and the cooperative European programs to develop the centrifuge method for separation of the isotopes of uranium. Extensive discussions have been held about an all-European diffusion plant for separating uranium-235, but so far there have been few tangible results. Footnote, the symbol 235U denotes the uranium isotopes with atomic weight 235. Corresponding symbols are used for isotopes of plutonium, Pu, and thorium, Th. Of these isotopes, the ones with odd atomic weights, namely 233U, 235U, and 239Pu, are fissile. Technical cooperation in nuclear energy among partners of comparable standing must be limited to projects that satisfy certain obvious conditions. Each partner must derive benefits from participation, yet no partner can derive large commercial or military advantage at the expense of the other participants. The successful intra-European projects satisfy these conditions. Thus, all cooperate completely on fusion, which is still relatively far away, and to a lesser degree on the fast breeder reactor, which is somewhat closer at hand. On the other hand, reactors that are by now articles of commerce, such as the UK gas-cooled graphite or the US light water reactors, are no longer proper subjects for close international cooperative development. That may have been a mistake. Euratom sponsors Europe's most extensive cooperative development of nuclear energy. The Euratom idea received great impetus after the first closing of the Suez Canal. Shortly thereafter, Euratom projected the installation of 15 million kilowatts of nuclear power in its member countries. At the time, this seemed like a most optimistic projection, and indeed until this past year or so, it was regarded as an optimistic estimate. However, by now, 15 million kilowatts of nuclear power in the Euratom countries does not seem at all excessive. Presently, the Euratom countries are committed to 31 million kilowatts of nuclear power. Euratom has been active in many fields of nuclear research. Its most ambitious undertaking has been the operation of the Ispra laboratory in Italy. This is a large, excellently staffed laboratory that has focused its major effort on the heavy water moderated organic cooled reactor, Orgel. Unfortunately, the Orgel has been squeezed out by the success of both the gas-cooled and the light water reactors. At the moment, ISPRA is in the process of redeploying around larger, longer-range prospects, some of which will probably be non-nuclear. Whether or not this presages a broadening... Whether or not this presages a broadening of the interest of Euratom itself to include, for example, environmental questions, remains to be seen. I will remark that this is a somewhat premature closing out of that line of development because the light water reactors, have proven costly. What I have described thus far has been, to my mind, the lesser derivative promise of international nuclear energy. It is fine that a cooperative worldwide attack on common scientific and technological problems associated with nuclear energy has gone forward, on the whole, with rather good success. And it is even better that bona fide international production projects, such as the radiochemical plant at Mol, are operating. These efforts promote international exchange and presumably a feeling of friendship among the cooperating parties. But all this is a small thing compared with Wells' original vision of a world set free by nuclear energy. If the international implications of peaceful nuclear energy amount only to scientific and technological cooperation among different nations, the world will have fallen far short of realizing the full potential of the peaceful atom. What can we say 28 years after the Stagfield chain reaction, about the peaceful atom providing those new options that could indeed change historic politico-economic problems into non-problems? If there are such possibilities, are they so distant that prudent politicians cannot consider them in their present-day planning? To what extent are the Wellsians among the nuclear community, who insist that the promise of the atom is not being overestimated, guilty of trying to solve today's social problems with tomorrow's or even the day after tomorrow's technology. To what extent should one take their optimism seriously? It seems obvious that a new prime source of energy, one that is in principle available to everyone, must have great potential geopolitical implications. How this works is suggested by the Suez Crisis of 1956. Here, a new technology of transporting energy, namely the big tanker, greatly reduced the political impact of the closing of the Suez Canal. There is little doubt, despite the cries of some extreme environmentalists, that even by 1980, nuclear power in its present embodiments will provide a sizable part of the world's central station power. The United States is now committed to more than 87 million kilowatts of nuclear power from reactors of current design. Western Europe and England to 30 million kilowatts, the Soviet Union to 8,800,000 kilowatts, and so on. The strong likelihood is that, by the turn of the century, the nucleus will be the primary source of central station power. Stationary central power represents considerably less than half the world's total energy budget. To what extent can nuclear power provide mobile, as opposed to stationary power? Here, we move from demonstrated technology to a much more speculative possibility. The key chemical is hydrogen. If hydrogen can be obtained economically from water and nuclear energy by electrolysis or by thermal cracking, then the route to liquid fuel is straightforward. Hydrogen and limestone yield methane and, if one wishes, heavier hydrocarbons. Whether such a circuitous path to an energy economy independent of petroleum sources can ever be taken fully seriously, say, in competition with liquid fuel from coal, remains to be seen. Yet it is significant that the ISPRA laboratory thinks enough of this approach to put a good-sized team to work on the production of hydrogen from water using nuclear energy as the primary energy source. The long-range aim here, as stated by the ISPRA people, is to provide Europe with an independent source of mobile energy within 50 years. The route to liquid fuel, and indeed to many of man's essential commodities, such as ammonia fertilizer or basic metals, through nuclear-produced hydrogen, must not be taken seriously in the short run, that is, within the next 10 to 15 years, though there are specific spots in the world where electrolytic hydrogen is competitive with hydrogen from coal or oil even now. On the other hand, it hardly stretches one's credulity to imagine that processes for obtaining hydrogen from water and nuclear energy at generally competitive prices will be developed within 50 years. Nor is 50 years an impossibly long time as far as modern heavy technology is concerned. More than 30 years have passed since fission was discovered, and it may be another 10 or 15 years before the ultimate fission energy source, the breeder reactor, is fully developed. The key to all these long-range possibilities is a nuclear energy source that uses an inexhaustible fuel. Here, there are two possibilities, fusion reactors and fission breeders. Though much optimism now reigns within the fusion project, no one can reliably estimate the time needed to achieve success. Fusion, therefore, cannot be regarded as a technology upon whose availability public policy can be based. The breeder, on the other hand, poses no crucial scientific questions. Its success depends on working out expensive engineering details, and therefore it is possible to give some estimate of when it will be available. The fission breeder, in contrast to the present generation of reactors, in effect burns the very abundant 238U or 232TH isotopes, rather than the very rare 235U or its man-made counterparts 239PU or 233U. In the breeder, the latter materials are simply catalysts that are regenerated as the more abundant isotopes are burned. Now, 238U and 232TH are ubiquitous, and because they represent such an enormously concentrated source of energy, it would not be out of the question to burn in breeder reactors even the residual uranium and thorium found in the granitic rocks. The amount of energy thereby made available is truly enormous. Enough to last mankind on any reasonable energy budget for many millions of years. Thus, the development of the breeder, which burns the rocks, no less than of the controlled fusion reactor, which burns the seas, would provide man with the basis for Wells' dream of ubiquitous, reasonably cheap energy, essentially forever. It is on this account that the entire nuclear community has turned its collective attention to the development of breeder reactors, and there is cooperation, though it is not fully open, between all the participants: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the Soviet Union, Japan, Germany, Italy. With any luck, we should have large commercial breeders operating in the mid-1980s, 45 years after the discovery of fission. What emerges is the outline of an autarkic world, one in which the primary energy source based on breeder reactors, or if we are lucky, on fusion reactors, is available to all countries, not only to countries that possess indigenous fossil fuel or are rich enough to import such fuel from others. And from the prime energy source can flow, ultimately, secondary energy, fertilizers, metals, water from the sea. Fossilized hydrocarbons would be reserved for use as chemical raw materials. You see what the anti-nuclear movement has robbed us of. This, say the realists, is a figment of Wells' imagination. Yet, even in the short run, nuclear energy is now making a difference. For example, in the development of India. Two boiling water reactors at Tarapur have been supplying 400 megawatts of power to the western grid of about 2,500 megawatts for more than a year. And in the middle run, say, within 15 years, there are at least two projects based on rather well-developed technology that could have important world impact. The first is the Indo-Gangetic Plain Tube Well Project. The Indo-Gangetic Plain is underlaid with huge reservoirs, with huge rivers of groundwater that are replenished each year by the monsoon rains. Were it possible to pump this groundwater for irrigation, much of the area could be triple cropped. It could become a vast San Joaquin Valley. If the new high-yielding wheats were planted, and if sufficient ammonia fertilizer were made available, then, according to Professor Perry Stout of the University of California at Davis, this area alone might produce 72 million tons of wheat each year. Professor Stout visualizes 94,000 tube wells covering an area of 8 million acres, along with a network of ammonia plants based on production of electrolytic hydrogen. The prime missing element in all this is energy, to drive the tube wells, to energize the ammonia plants, to provide the incidental power that the ancillary industry in such a complex would need. The full project would ultimately require 6 million kilowatts. Since most of the area possesses no fossil fuel, nuclear reactors of current types would be used. The Indo-Gangetic Tube Well Project is not a far-off dream. It is an option to be reckoned with seriously. The first element of the scheme, involving 25,000 tube wells and 1 million kilowatts produced by two nuclear reactors, has been presented to the Indian government by the Department of Atomic Energy. This part of the project is estimated to cost $1.56 billion to produce 8 million of additional tons of wheat per year and to yield a 70% return on the initial investment. The second middle-range possibility is nuclear desalting in the Middle East. Here, the initial idea again was put forward by President Eisenhower. The scheme envisaged a string of large dual-purpose nuclear power plants that would supply water and power for coastal areas of the Sinai Desert, Israel, and the Lower Negev. The Eisenhower idea was taken up in 1967 by Senator Howard H. Baker, Jr. of Tennessee, and was embodied in Senate Resolution 155. This resolution urged that nuclear desalting be promoted as a means of providing additional arable land in the Middle East. Not much has been heard about the Eisenhower-Baker plan since Senate Resolution 155 was passed, but for the past 2 years, technical examination of the general idea has been going on at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory with the cooperation of IAEA and representatives from several of the nations that might profit from the scheme. It would serve no purpose for me at this time to summarize in detail our technical findings. Nevertheless, certain realities should be understood before the idea is facilely rejected, as has been the tendency among hard-headed economists. 1. The incremental cost of water for agriculture in Israel is now 35 cents per 1,000 gallons. This is close to the predicted cost of water from large dual-purpose nuclear plants. 2. The water table in the Gaza Strip is falling. There will almost certainly be a water crisis there within a decade. 3. New land, which desalting in effect supplies, opens new political options. I do not contend that the Eisenhower-Baker plan, exactly as the late president put it forward, is itself a realistic option. I do insist, however, that some variant of the basic idea, in which nuclear energy plays a role in supplying new water, deserves serious attention. The Indo-Gangetic and the Eisenhower-Baker plans fall short of Wells' world set free. On the other hand, they are tangible examples of how the new source of energy might make a political difference. That within the first 30 years of the nuclear age, we find possible applications of nuclear energy that may help us provide food for India and water and land for the Middle East is, to my mind, miraculous, especially since these seem to me to be real possibilities, not mere visions. Is it too much to believe that within the next 50 years, the other promises of nuclear energy will be realized? Cheap and ubiquitous power, mobile fuel via hydrogen, large-scale desalting, and others. The answer is, yes, these things can happen, but only if the statesmen of the world continue to give vigorous support to the development of nuclear energy and its associated technologies. So yes, that's a message of hope for the world there from Dr. Alvin Weinberg. I'm now going to read the 1977 essay, Is Nuclear Energy Acceptable? All of this, of course, is far more poignant at the moment. Between the IPCC report just released, which basically says that we haven't done anything like enough, either in terms of emissions reduction or in terms of mitigation and adaptation, and of the war in Ukraine, which has been made possible in large part by the anti-nuclear movement in Germany, for example, and the large demand for Russian gas, other fossil fuels, which to a great extent have helped to prop up an oppressive regime in Germany, in Russia, as well as to limit the political options that Europe has when dealing with Russia, one of their major suppliers of fossil fuels. Introduction. By 1977, nuclear energy was in retreat. The Browns Ferry fire had affected the public at large. At our Institute for Energy Analysis, we had conducted a study on the, quote, economic and environmental implications of a nuclear moratorium 1985 to 2010. We concluded that the United States, blessed with abundant coal, could manage for the next 30 years, even if no new reactors were built, but to depend entirely on coal was an unpleasant prospect, and we had begun to examine possible ways of restructuring the nuclear enterprise. This essay, and the one that follows, contain some of our ideas for such a restructuring. This essay is based in part on the 1976 distinguished lecture given to graduate students in nuclear engineering at Purdue University. It appeared in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, page 54, April 1977. The talk summarized views being developed at IEA. The ideas were well received by the audience. This surprised me, since I was calling for a drastic overhauling of the nuclear enterprise. Perhaps not surprising, I found the younger people in the nuclear establishment generally more receptive to some of these ideas than were their elders. That the acceptability of nuclear energy is shadowed by doubt is painful to those of us who have devoted our careers to peaceful nuclear energy. 25 years ago, we were hailed as harbingers of a new and more abundant age based upon nuclear energy. Today, many of us feel like Horatius at the bridge. Often we find ourselves subjected to abuse, to accusations of dishonesty or cowardice, because we continue to insist, despite noisy protests, that nuclear energy is a good thing, not a bad thing, and that it is man's good fortune to have come upon this miracle at the same time we began depleting fossil fuels at an alarming rate. The opposition to nuclear energy is hardening. There is a non-zero chance that the public will turn away from nuclear energy, that those who are intent on abolishing nuclear energy may succeed in so doing. Indeed, what began as a debate on nuclear energy has taken on the aspect of a war of annihilation. It is, as Senator John O. Pastore of Rhode Island is alleged to have said, easier to scare people than it is to unscare them. I have probably scared some people in describing nuclear energy as a Faustian bargain, an arrangement in which man promises meticulous and persistent attention to detail in exchange for an inexhaustible and, in principle, a non-polluting energy source. My purpose here will be twofold. First, I shall try to unscare people, that is, to place the hazard of nuclear energy in perspective. My second purpose is farther reaching. It is to set forth proposals for the future development of nuclear energy that might serve as the basis for compromise between the opponents and the proponents of nuclear energy. If none of the products of fission were radioactive, or if plutonium were neither radioactive nor capable of sustaining a fast neutron chain reaction, and therefore were not a nuclear explosive, there would be little question about nuclear energy being at least as desirable as fossil-based energy. Again, I'm afraid Dr. Weinberg misses the point. Many of the opponents of nuclear energy have come out to say that they oppose it precisely because it is cheap and abundant. They want the limitations of fossil fuels and the so-called renewables. The most recent estimates of the costs of energy, the most recent estimates of the cost of electricity generated in large plants completed in the late 1970s are about 22 mils per kilowatt hour for nuclear and coal-fired plants, about 28 mils for oil-fired plants. These numbers are based on 70% plant capacity factors, coal at $20 per ton, oil at $12 per barrel. For plants completed in 1985, the average costs during the first 10 years of plant life are 38, 42, and 55 mils per kilowatt hour, respectively. Estimates of capital costs of coal and nuclear power plants built in 1985 are hardly reliable. Barry Commoner, for example, asserts that nuclear plants by then will be too expensive to compete with fossil plants. But in his estimates, he forgot that coal plants using high-sulfur eastern coal will require expensive scrubbers, and that low-sulfur western coal burned in the east is expensive. It appears that nuclear plants will continue to be competitive in the 1980s, though this could change if scrubbers prove unnecessary or if the price of coal falls. Over the long term, an alternative to fossil fuel is almost surely needed, even with the conservation that is implied in reducing our growth of energy from 4.5% per year to 2% annually. The alternatives we visualize now are geothermal, fusion, solar, and fission. Geothermal will surely be used more extensively, but it is a relatively small source of energy. Fusion has yet to be shown to be feasible. Solar and its children, wind, waves, ocean thermal gradients, bioconversion, as sources of energy, are in many cases intermittent and appear to be either very expensive. Electricity from a solar-driven steam system would cost 80 mils per kilowatt hour, according to Minneapolis Honeywell, or small, wind. Only fission seems to have been demonstrated both technically and economically. It is, I believe, irresponsible and dangerous for nuclear abolitionists to imply that solar electricity is clearly a tenable alternative and one that would not cost society very heavily should we turn away from fission as they advocate. What about the environmental impacts of fission? Properly operating reactors and their supporting subsystems damage the environment far less than conventional coal-fired power plants. The routine emissions, now limited to 5 millirems per year to individuals at the plant boundary, represent less than 5% of natural background radiation. Mining and milling of uranium is, per unit of energy extracted, far less dangerous to our health than conventional coal mining. And because uranium is a concentrated fuel, its extraction does less damage to the environment than does strip mining of coal. It is true, on the other hand, that light water reactors operating at 30% thermal efficiency throw out 50% more heat than does a fossil plant operating at 40% efficiency. To summarize, nuclear reactors, when properly operating, represent a superb long-term source of prime energy. They are probably as cheap as, if not cheaper, and do less violence to the environment than any other large-scale prime source of thermal energy. The hazards. But nuclear reactors do produce immense amounts of radioactivity. Plutonium is an explosive, and reactors will not always operate properly. Thus, we are assuming certain risks when we opt for nuclear power. Are the risks worth the benefits? The major argument against nuclear energy by the nuclear abolitionists is that the meticulous attention to detail demanded by nuclear energy is beyond man's capability. If a serious accident should occur, or if fissile material were diverted to a bomb, the nuclear enterprise would very possibly be terminated. Therefore, say the critics, it is better to halt the enterprise now, when it is relatively small, and not risk a shutdown of a major source of energy, than to become too dependent on what some consider an undependable source of energy. The issue, then, is, would an accident be likely to shut down the industry? And what, indeed, are the probabilities of a major accident? To the first question, I would say yes. A very serious reactor accident, one that caused many people to die, would probably shut down the industry at this time, especially with such escalated concerns. Thus, the aim of the nuclear enterprise must be to avoid at all costs a really serious nuclear accident, one that affects many people adversely. The second question. What is the probability of a major accident is, by its very nature, unanswerable in a strict scientific sense. The most serious attempt to quantify the risk of accident from a light water reactor has been made by Norman Rasmussen of MIT in an extensive study sponsored by the Atomic Energy Commission. The main result of the Rasmussen study is to dispel the oversimplification that failure of the emergency core cooling system automatically spells catastrophe. Even if the ECCS should fail, above ground containment usually is not breached, at least in the pressurized water reactor. Moreover, even if containment is breached, the large majority of cases would lead to an accident that is far less serious than the thousands of deaths predicted in the old WASH 740 report. More specifically, the Rasmussen study predicts that the probability of a meltdown in a pressurized water reactor is 1 in 20,000 per reactor year, and most of these meltdowns would not breach the main containment above the reactor. The risk to an individual of being fatally injured by an accident in 100 light water reactors is not greater than 1 in 5 billion per year. The worst accident, which the Rasmussen study estimates might happen once in 1 billion years per reactor, might cause 3,300 immediate fatalities, about 10 times that number of early illnesses, some additional genetic effects and long-term cancers, and perhaps $14 billion in property damage. The Rasmussen study has been praised and criticized, mainly on the grounds that uncertainties of unknown origin are inherent in any such estimates, and that the dangers may be underestimated by a large factor. Rasmussen himself states that the uncertainty in estimating the frequency of nuclear events lies between 1/5 and 5, the uncertainty in estimating consequences between 1/4 and 4. One can never totally refute such arguments. What is in principle unknowable is unknowable, and there is no way to settle the issue scientifically. But this much is essential and has been proved by Rasmussen. The oversimplified view that failure of the emergency core cooling system automatically spells catastrophe, that is, that containment and ECCS are really in parallel, not in series, was wrong. Yet it was precisely this point that underlay the lengthy and controversial hearings on emergency core cooling systems. Was this system absolutely necessary to prevent catastrophe? The answer of Rasmussen is no. Even if the ECCS should fail, most of the time, the damage to the public would be relatively minor. 2 points are illustrated here. The first is that we are still learning things about nuclear reactors, and indeed the nuclear community is committed to increasing the safety of its devices. Rasmussen's results strongly suggest that reactors already are safe enough, in the sense that the likelihood of something serious happening with those reactors that are now deployed is so small as to make it unnecessary to go back and extensively refit those we already have online. Of course, he was assuming a 30-year lifetime for the reactors. If Fukushima Daiichi number 1 had been taken offline after 30 years, nobody would ever have bothered about it. Disaster insurance. But what about the inherent conflict between our desire to make reactors as cheap as possible, a desire that is independent of whether the reactor is built in a socialist or capitalist country, and the requirement to make the reactor as safe as possible? Again, this is not an issue that can be resolved scientifically. This is a matter that is inherently adjudicable only by the interplay of conflicting social forces. It is because of this inherent conflict that I generally favor the recent modifications of the Price-Anderson indemnity provisions of the Atomic Energy Act. The original law limited the liability that can arise from a nuclear accident. This liability was set at $560 million, of which the U.S. government now provides $440 million. In exchange for limit of liability, the insurance is no fault, that is, claimants are not required to sue for redress. Okay, that copy operation has now finished after an hour. Price-Anderson, in some respects, is now an anachronism. I see no reason why the industry itself should not pay for the entire insurance, and indeed the new Price-Anderson law calls for retroactive premiums of $5 million per reactor to be paid after an accident that causes damage that exceeds what is covered through regular insurance. But this is still not good enough. I believe we should recognize that with nuclear energy we have an almost unique situation, very small probability of very great damage. The Rasmussen report suggests that the probability of an accident in 100 present-day reactors causing property damage of $1 billion is about 1 in 1 million, though there is considerable uncertainty in both of these numbers. I would argue that, up to some number such as this, the industry accepts the entire risk, say by retroactive assessments of premiums on all reactors after an accident has occurred. Beyond this, say for accidents that cost more than $1 billion damage, I propose that the government assume responsibility, as it now does in the case of floods and other natural disasters. I'm sorry to say that Dr. Weinberg here shows a very narrow perspective, although a lot of people share it. They seem to think, oh, these are unique risks. Well, Bhopal proved for good and all that this just isn't true. The most deadly industrial accident in history was either the Bhopal chemical plant accident or the River Rue dam failures. Either way you look at it, neither of them had anything to do with nuclear energy. These are not unique risks. Indeed, the risks of an actual nuclear accident may be much smaller. Certainly neither Three Mile Island nor Fukushima nor even Chernobyl was as severe in many respects. Anyway, by placing large but not bankrupting liability on the utility, one certainly places pressure on the utility to weigh the safest possible, cheapest possible balance on the side of safety. On the other hand, by explicitly making the government the insurer of last resort, one protects the public in those accidents that might bankrupt the reactor operator. Of course, the utilities would pay insurance to the government for this ultimate protection. What this premium should be would be determined actuarially. How do you determine actuarially something that doesn't happen often enough to build an actuarial table? According to Rasmussen's calculations and standard actuarial procedures, to insure against an accident that costs $14 billion property damage and 3,300 fatalities at $1 million per fatality would cost only a few thousand dollars per year per reactor. What I propose here amounts to placing extremely unlikely accidents in the category of acts of God. This flies against judicial tradition that holds the owner of a device responsible regardless of the improbability of an accident. Yet reactors do pose an almost unprecedented situation, and I would think new principles of jurisprudence are needed to handle the very small risk, very great damage situation. Moreover, this proposal makes the government the insurer of last resort. It could be viewed as a natural extension of present disaster insurance policy, modified for the almost unique risk posed by nuclear energy. I have been careful to qualify my description of reactor risks as almost unique. Nuclear energy poses a risk because so much energy is concentrated in a reactor, but this is true of other power plants, most notably large dams. The gravitational energy contained in Hoover Dam is enormous, some 10 billion kilowatt hours. That is, it is equal to the energy generated in a 1 million kilowatt reactor operating for a year. It has been estimated by David Okrent and others at UCLA that the failure of the Folsom Dam on the American River above Sacramento would cause the death of 260,000 people. The probability of failure of concrete dams such as Folsom is 1 in 10,000 per year. Yet the failure of dams is something to which we have somehow become accustomed. The risks associated with coal-fired power plants are, of course, large. B.L. Cohen has estimated that a 1,000-megawatt coal-fired power plant might kill each year some 70 people by emission of sulfur dioxide and other noxious fumes. This is in addition to the damage done as the result of the underground coal mining. Several hundred thousand coal miners now receive compensation for black lung disease. There is also the specter of a climatic change caused by accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This possibility is hard to assess, though some climatologists believe it to be a real danger. So much has been written about the other potential hazards of nuclear reactors: proliferation, low-level radiation, diversion of fissile material, sabotage, plutonium toxicity, and even disposal of wastes, that I shall not add to this already voluminous literature. My own view is that proliferation is basically an insoluble problem and is only incidentally connected with power reactors. As to the others, I consider waste disposal almost surely resolvable by techniques now at hand, and the others either to be non-problems, low-level release, or susceptible to much better handling by methods I shall describe later. can people be unscared? Despite the reassurances that I and other nuclear proponents give, portions of the public remain unconvinced. The threat to the nuclear option remains real. What is there about the nuclear risk that is somehow different and causes the distrust that undoubtedly exists? To say that there is general distrust of big technology and of proponents of big technology is true, but this is only part of the difficulty. Nuclear energy began as a military enterprise. Man first handled radioactivity on a very large scale with the building of the plutonium production facilities at Hanford, Washington. That mistakes were made, for example, the use of ground disposal for low-level liquid wastes, or the use of tanks that can leak for liquid storage, is not surprising. All one can say to this is that standards are much more rigid now than they were during the war. Wastes will be solidified, and in fact are being solidified at ARCO and on a smaller scale at Hanford. To the accusation that the nuclear community cannot be trusted, I can only say that the nuclear community is much more open than it previously was. The separation of the regulatory and development functions of nuclear energy in the Energy Reorganization Act of 1974 will help keep us and those who follow us honest. I question that, but never mind. As for the intrinsic hazards to life of nuclear energy, with one exception, the persistence of radioactivity, they are no different, and in some respects are much smaller, than the intrinsic hazards of other energy-producing systems. As for actually killing people, the numbers seem to favor nuclear by a large margin. If we compare nuclear reactors with automobiles, the comparison is striking. The dangers from autos are real and stark. 50,000 people will die on the road every year. By contrast, the dangers from nuclear energy are presumptive. No one has been killed by radioactivity from a commercial nuclear power reactor. Nor can it be the idea that a sudden large catastrophe is much less acceptable than a series of small catastrophes spread over time and over very many people. A dam represents a potential sudden catastrophe that, again, is a real, not a presumptive danger. Yet few people really worry about 10 billion kilowatt hours of gravitational energy impounded behind Hoover Dam. To be sure, the property damage that could conceivably be caused by a reactor failure might exceed that caused by failure of any other man-made device, but certainly not by orders of magnitude. And the probability of this happening, according to Rasmussen, is almost infinitesimal, 1 in 10 million per 100 reactor years for a $14 billion catastrophe. There are four essential elements that I suspect are responsible for the peculiar concern over nuclear energy. 1. The possibility of diversion. This risk is not shared by the other energy technologies, and it is something we have lived with since the advent of the nuclear bomb. In that case, we accepted the risk in return for something we felt very worthwhile, victory in World War II, mutual deterrence that has staved off World War III despite the predictions of many Cassandras. I should think that we would be prepared to accept the smaller risk of diversion from nuclear power plants in the interest of maintaining our energy system. 2. The newness of the radiation hazard. Though radiation is part of our natural environment, many of us are terror-stricken by the idea of being harmed by radiation. In a way, it is reminiscent of the early fears over the possibility of electrocution when electricity became widespread. By now, most have made psychological peace with the hazard of electricity. We would expect that as man lives with radiation, he will acquire the same attitude toward it. One does not deal with radiation carelessly, but neither does one panic over it. 3. The persistence of the radiation hazard. This is the most unique part of the nuclear hazard. Widespread contamination of land could be difficult to clean up, so that the land might be interdicted for a very long time. It is this aspect of the nuclear hazard that prompts me to urge cluster siting, to put only a few spots on the planet at risk of persistent contamination. This was the underlying idea of placing reactors at Hanford in an isolated area, so that, come what might, the effluents would not cause much damage. Okay, I have to break off here. I guess I'll pick up there next time. Thank you for listening in. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, you could, of course, always send me money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, or subscribe to my Patreon campaign, patreon.com/Publius_Reads. But equally, you could write me a card or a letter. I look forward to receiving them. Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. Very likely I'll read them aloud over the air. And now, coming up next is Evolution Revolution with DJ Damaru, who undoubtedly has an interesting show for us today.
Evolution Revolution with DJ Damaru.